We are speaking with Erin Goodison, Director of Supportive Housing at Safe Place. And Erin, I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself properly because your organization has a little bit of a different identity than I attributed.
I'm Erin Goodison. I'm the Director of Supportive Housing at Safe Place, a partner agency of the Safe Alliance in Austin, Texas.
We're going to talk for a little while about some of the features of Safe Place and how you deliver transitional housing and your other housing services. So I'm going to start by asking you to talk about the different kinds of housing that's used by the program and a little bit about the advantages of having several different housing models.
We're very fortunate here at Safe Place to be able to offer about 50 units of transitional housing, and we do that through a couple of different models. We have a site-based program, and this is our 20th anniversary of offering our HUD-funded site-based transitional housing program. And then in addition, we have some scattered site units funded by an OVW transitional housing grant and through donations. This allows us to increase our overall housing stock, increase the opportunities for survivors to access this desperately needed transitional housing, and to really meet the individualized need of survivors.
And how do you decide where the best place is for a survivor to live? Is it a survivor's decision whether they're in the site-based program or in the community, or is it a joint decision, or how does that get made?
It is a collaborative decision. With a site-based program where we are fortunate to own the housing, and that is our biggest segment of our housing, we have extremely low barriers. So we're able to serve those who won't qualify for housing anywhere else due to criminal history, negative rental history, or any other type of barrier that might be a challenge for them, having no income. We also have enhanced security for our site-based services. It is a slightly lower security than our emergency shelter, but it is still more secure than what you would find in a regular apartment complex. And so we're really able to target those services to the people that need them most. In our scattered site housing, we're able to help survivors that may not want to live on our campus but would prefer to be in the community, perhaps to be closer to their work, to school, to their child's school, to supportive family and friends or church, whatever that need may be, or if they just feel safe and comfortable enough to get back out into the community, they just need some additional support as they make that transition. One of the real benefits of scattered site community-based transitional housing is for many survivors, they can transition in place. They put down those roots in a community, they have their children enrolled in school, and at the end of their time in transitional housing, they have the opportunity to stay in their same unit as long as they're able to maintain that rent on their own or if they've been able to obtain some other type of subsidy. So taking all of that into consideration, we participate in a victim services model of coordinated assessment. We use the same coordinated assessment tool that other homeless providers in the Austin community use, but we are able to protect survivors' information by doing that in-house so that all of their information stays confidential. And so then we screen for their vulnerability and need to prioritize referrals, and then we also screen for eligibility. Again, we don't have barriers to accessing our own site-based housing, but some of our housing partners may screen for certain types of criminal history or rental history, and so or family size in a certain unit. So we try and take all of their eligibility criteria into account.
You mentioned that you have a donation-based program in addition to the OVW, or maybe as part of the OVW program. Can you talk a little bit about how that works?
It's a very small number of units, but we have two ways that we have been able to do that. Currently, we have three units that are essentially donated to us by a private landlord. They get the tax benefit for the donation, and then we are able to sublease these units on a transitional basis to residents. So there's no cost to us for the housing, but we do have to find a way to provide the supportive services to those residents residents and also provide support and coordination with the landlord. And then in addition to that, we were fortunate to have a donor who essentially funds two units of transitional housing in the community just by a cash donation.
That's awesome. And should I assume that the units that are donated by the landlords are not transition in place?
The landlord has been willing to work with us if a resident wants to stay in the unit to try and find us another unit in the same property for donation. But the truth is the rents have gotten so high in Austin, even for these generous landlords, that it's been a number of years since any of our residents were able to afford to stay in place in one of these units.
When we talked a little bit about your program, it sounded like you offer some clinical services for participants. And in some programs, it's a little bit controversial. Some providers are concerned that by inserting clinical services, a program might be pathologizing domestic and sexual violence when, at their basic level, they're about an abusive person exploiting and exercising power and control over another person. But on the other hand, domestic violence and sexual assault are very traumatizing experiences, and there are real consequences to the physical, emotional, and psychological health of the survivor, which can affect their ability in many aspects of their lives, including if their parents, their relationships with their children. How do you balance that?
We try to keep in mind that we want to be very trauma-informed and always remember the role of the abuse in perhaps creating and definitely exploiting any type of disability, disabling condition, or barrier. I mean, that is a very intentional tactic that an abuser or perpetrator might use to isolate and control a survivor. And then we also want to recognize all the other barriers that might exist, not only to accessing help for safety, for shelter, to escape the relationship, but also in getting help with some of those impacts of trauma. We try to keep in mind that survivors may have had experience with systems, all types of systems, governmental, non-governmental, as well as mental health and health systems, that may have been oppressive or abusive to them, or in some way complicit in the abuse by their perpetrator, perhaps in not recognizing the dynamics of domestic or sexual violence, child abuse, or exploitation that was going on. So taking all of that into account, we understand that the people we serve have been harmed and impacted by their traumatic experiences of abuse, and that's going to impact them in all areas of their lives, but that they may not have found help and support in systems before. And what we've found that works well is developing partnership with systems to offer an on-site mental health clinic and an on-site primary care clinic, to partner for well woman exams and other types of health care to help address transportation barriers. And through that partnership, to educate the providers about the impacts of trauma, the barriers that folks can address when they're trying to get help, what those needs are going to be so that they can respond as supportively as possible. And then on the other side, making sure that all of these services are completely voluntary. We're just trying to provide the opportunity to access really high quality care and support if that's something that the survivor identifies that they need, but not to diagnose, not to require, not to tie strings into certain types of services.
How would the subject get brought up? Would it be something that you mentioned that you offer? Would it be something that one of your staff might suggest that a person look into? How does it get brought up to the participant?
The majority of the survivors that we serve in transitional housing are coming from our emergency shelter, and our emergency shelter is the site where our clinics are held. So many, if they were interested, have already established care at the time that they were staying in the emergency shelter. And at shelter, it is just offered as, if you have this need, we can help offer the service here, or if you prefer to see another provider and you have that need, we'll try and help you safely access your preferred provider as well. when we're doing our transitional housing intake, we try to do needs assessment and then talk to folks about here is the full menu of services that we offer, either through our own staff or through partnerships, and let us know if you're interested in this or if you have questions, and we can provide more information. If folks initially aren't interested in services, one of the most frequent ways that people later seek out additional support services is through their connection with peer support. We find that our peer support staff and volunteers often make a different type of connection with survivors and in sharing their own experiences of surviving abuse and moving forward with their lives and the things that they found helpful and supportive. Sometimes that helps reduce the stigma in asking for help. It helps explain the context of all these different impacts that trauma can have, and that's okay. It's normal that you would have a response to traumatic experiences. It would actually be strange not to have any responses or impacts. And so peer support has also been a really, really vital way that survivors feel confident asking for more help and maybe linking to recovery support, mental health counseling or treatment, as well as addressing any physical health issues that they have.
Is that something that's also used by people who are in community-based placements, or is that primarily a feature of the site-based programming, the peer support?
So our peer support program offers group services that are facilitated by our trained peer support volunteers, both in our shelter and on-site at our resource center. And the groups are open to shelter and transitional housing residents no matter where they live. And then our peer support staff person who trains and supervises all of the peer support volunteers is also available to do outreach and can connect with folks if they're not able to get here on-site, can go do some home-based work with our other transitional housing residents.
Let me ask you just a little bit, one more topic about how you work with parents and their children. There are some different opinions about the proper role of transitional housing programs in addressing the needs of children of survivors. On the one hand, the parent is the gatekeeper of services, and in a program that embraces voluntary services and survivor empowerment, it's important not to compromise the role of the parent in making decisions about her child's well-being and participation in services. On the other hand, parents may not be aware of or comfortable acknowledging the impact of exposure to violence on their children, or the impact of that violence on their own ability to be as attentive and nurturing a parent as they might want to be. So how do you, again, find a balance in supporting parents in their relationships with their children and in exploring some of the impacts of trauma and exposure to violence that their children may have experienced?
Some of our frontline children staff who work with children in the after-school program or by providing therapeutic activities during life skills classes or counseling groups for the adult, as well as our staff that work with the children attending our child development center or our charter school, they are often a great person to make a connection with the parent and talk about different things that are coming up for their child. And when a parent's expressing some struggle, offering linkages to other resources, parent coaches, classes, talking about play therapy or other types of therapeutic services for children. And that can kind of help let the parent lead. You know, we always want to let the parent lead in identifying things, but make sure that we're providing lots of opportunities to have those conversations. For the adult-focused staff, that may be a primary point of contact with the parent, an advocate, a counselor, we always try to provide a lot of information, again, normalizing the responses, the varied responses to trauma, and how in children that may come out in a lot of different ways, physical and mental health, but also behavior, play, interactions, sleep disturbances, bedwet, you know, just the full range of things that might happen for a child, and understanding that's a normal part of their processing, but offering that linkage and support so that it's always clear to the protective parent, to our survivors, it's nothing that you have done wrong. In fact, we understand you've done everything in your power to keep your child safe and buffer them from any negative experiences, but that they are on their own sort of path to healing along with you. And finding what works, finding the support that everybody needs is just a part of figuring that all out.
Erin, you just mentioned some amazing children's resources. How does your agency sustain those resources? They're not typically the kinds of programming that a domestic violence agency might be able to offer. How do you manage to sustain that kind of programming for children?
Well, we've been very fortunate. We have a K-12 charter school that is a partnership with the University of Texas. And so they provide the staff for the school, and we provide the facility space. But then we also provide, in addition, children's advocate and a school coordinator. So there is some cost and staff time, but those liaison positions and additional support positions can be huge in helping teachers and educators understand trauma and its impacts on children and on their parents and some of the challenges that may come up in the school, and also connecting all the different support staff to best help that family to heal. Our Child Development Center, you know, really grew out of that need. There's so much difficulty in navigating the legal ramifications of leaving an abusive relationship, particularly if you share a child with your abuser. And so it is very hard when there might be a risk to either the victim parent or the child if they have to go out to a school or to a child care center where they could easily be reached by the abuser. And so it was really important to us to have safe options for both parents and children so that they can have as normal and enriched a life as possible, but when that level of safety concern was present, that they would be able to stay safe, stay on our campus where an abuser or perpetrator cannot get to them. And we've used a mix of funding. Our Child Development Center serves both staff children and clients' children, and they really have to work that balance of how much space to reserve for staff children, where the staff then pay, and then how much space for the children of our residents and the children of our clients. And then they work really hard with programs like WorkSource Solutions and Child Care Solutions to access subsidies for our resident parents. And then we also just work miracles to keep the doors open and keep enough staff, since many of our residents don't have the ability to pay.
That sounds wonderful. Congratulations on having such a comprehensive resource to be able to offer to folks who need it.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.